U.S. stocks rallied to the highest point in nearly 5 months, with bull's eyes firmly on new stock market records. Welcome to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak. It's great to be back with you. We've got an grande size show for you with two huge guests. Jim Rogers, from his office in Singapore, says twice as many U.S. stocks were down in 2015 than up. This is a bearish breath indication. And he's holding on tight to his gold and silver, looking for opportunities to add to the stockpile. He has all kinds of unconventional investment ideas. Then John Williams from ShadowStats joins the show. He likes gold and silver coins. He prefers them over bullion bars. He thinks the U.S. economy never really recovered from the 2008 Great Recession. When you pull out corporate buyback impacts as well as Fed and their central bank comrade operations, there's not too much substance left there. He's looking for a Great Depression-like scenario and perhaps even worse. His projection on gold really tops anyone else we've ever seen on the show. He thinks it could be $100,000 an ounce, even $1 million an ounce or more, if and when the U.S. dollar returns to its true intrinsic value. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York COMEX exchange on the heels of a two-month advance. Even though the dollar fell to the lowest levels in months, there was mixed results in the sector. However, by Friday's close, the L-metal was still up by 6 points for the week, about 0.5%, finishing at $12.22 an ounce. Silver ended at $15.05, off just 1%, about 15 cents, while the XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index finished at $69.72, up 2 points, 3.3%, while West Texas Intermediate crude finished at $36.79 per barrel, down a bit. A top story moving the markets, central banking operations. We see the Bank of Japan, as well as the ECB, along with Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, and a few other countries, setting rates below zero. History indicates that these low rates tend to push investors into gold and silver investments. Plus, the Perth Mint showed increased sales of 29%. That was 48,000 ounces of gold in March. Some gold coin sales jumped 45%, over 1 million ounces in 2015 from the year earlier. Silver sales climbed 7.3 million ounces from 4.6 to 7.3 million ounces, according to a Bloomberg report. Plus, with dovish comments from Fed Chair Janet Yellen, the central bank will proceed cautiously with rate hikes. This gave the dollar bulls even more to think about. The greenback fell to the lowest level in months, encouraging American Eagle coin sales, which have surged domestically, 83,500 ounces in February, up from 18,500 a year earlier. Moreover, gold ETF holdings continue to fill the treasure chest coffers to overflowing for the first time in years this quarter. Investments surged. Holdings increased 21% to 1,760 tons. That's the biggest gain since 2009, according to another Bloomberg report. Plus, trading on the COMEX Precious Metals Exchange showing record trade volumes in New York, reaching 14 million contracts for the first quarter. Precious metals, bottom line. Gold and silver testing support. Gold needs to hold 1,200, which it has so far, as well as 1,150. Silver is right at its support at 15 and is in a more precarious short-term position. If these supports hold, I continue to hold on to my forecasts, projections of $18 to $20 silver and gold $14 to $1,500. And then the requisite disclaimer, not a prediction, merely an opinion. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange. The bull stampede resumed in earnest. Investors were impressed with dovish comments from Fed head Dr. Yellen. By Friday's closing bell on the Dow, the market was up 277 points, finishing at 17,515. That's 1.5% roughly, while the S&P 500 picked up 36, ending at 2072, nearly 2%. The NASDAQ added 141, topping them all with a 3% gain, coming within earshot of that 5,000 level, ending at 4914 for the week. According to a Labor Department report on Friday, the U.S. added more jobs than economists had anticipated. The U.S. created 215,000 new jobs in March. However, the national unemployment rate inched higher for the first time that I can recall in years, from 4.9 to 5%. Now, that is a very small incremental change, but it is a regime change, a change in trend or direction. And that's somewhat surprising, but I think we, for now, can discount that somewhat due to the labor participation rate, which is rock solid. Bottom line on Wall Street. Market volatility, as viewed by the CBOT, VIX remain very supportive. However, the fear to greed index continues up to excessive levels, and I think that means caution a bit advisable for the typical investor. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio with Jim Rogers and John Williams. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
Gold Seek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Jim Rogers, a globally renowned author, commentator, hedge fund manager, co-founder of the original Quantum Fund, author of many bestsellers. Welcome back.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. It's my pleasure.
You've been on record this year talking about a recession, and we're seeing a lot of signs of that. The stock market, it's really gone nowhere for a year. You seem to think this could be an important top for U.S. equities.
Well, yes. I mean, if you actually look at the market, the New York Stock Exchange, for instance, only one-third of stocks were up last year. Twice as many were down as up. If you look at the breadth, you know, the people, stocks advancing and declining, it peaked out in 2014, and the breadth has been going down ever since. So people may think the stock market is up, but for those who own stocks, they're finding out that that's not the case.
You know, it's been quite a run since 2008, 2009. Of course, if we take a look at the Fed's balance sheet, almost lockstep with this stock market rally. Do you see that correlation as key to the advance?
That's the only reason stocks are up. And they're not even up, as I said. This is all very artificial. Not just the Federal Reserve, central banks everywhere. This is the first time in recorded history that you've had everybody, all of the major central banks, I mean, you know, printing money. The Japanese, the Europeans, the British, the Americans, we're all doing it. Everybody thought this is a wonderful idea. Chris, I mean, of course it's not. It's going to end in disaster. It's already ending in disaster. As I said, most stocks are down worldwide, but let's use the U.S. since we're both Americans and the audience is American. Stocks are down. Despite the averages, despite a few stocks that are up a lot, stocks are down. This is not going to end in a lot of fun. It's going to end very badly for all of us.
You know, you've mentioned that this could be the last rally. I put that in quotes, and we're seeing, again, signs of that. These price-to-earnings ratios, the CAPE ratios, some of our individual stocks, 300, 500 price-to-earnings, I mean, they're priced for perfection for eternity. Could this lead to maybe a 1929-style scenario, or are we in worse or more dangerous waters?
Chris, we're certainly going to have worse times than we've had in our lifetimes. How bad it is, I expect it to be, well, to repeat, worse than anything we've had in our lifetime, because the debt is like nothing that's ever been in recorded history. America is now the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. Higher and higher, but so does everybody else's debt. So the next time around, yes, it's going to be very, very disastrous. The only hope, Chris, is if somehow the world survives the next time around. But it won't survive the one after that, I assure you, because the debt will be so much higher, money printing will be so much worse. We're going to live in very interesting times, which is, as you know, a Chinese curse to live in interesting times.
One of your comments reminds me of one of Einstein's comments. You might recall what he said about World War III. He said, I don't know about World War III, but World War IV will likely be fought with sticks and stones. I don't know how this recession will end, but the next one could be the end. So it sounds like you're talking about a nuclear option in our future. Ultimate day of reckoning, very difficult thing to put a finger on. So give us an idea then where those funds of yours are headed and where you feel safe right now.
I own a lot of U.S. dollars, not because it's not going to be a horrible currency in the end, but because with the bad times coming, many people will put their money in what they consider safe assets or safe haven, and many people think the U.S. dollar is a safe haven. Compared to the rest of the world, yeah, it is a safe haven compared to the yen or the euro, or, you know, other currencies. So I own U.S. dollars. I own Chinese renminbi. I own Chinese shares. I'm short in the U.S. I'm long agriculture. I bought recently some Russian government, short-term government bonds in rubles. I own some gold and silver, which I have for years. I haven't bought any recently. Some stocks that I've owned for 20 or 30 years, don't see any reason to sell them because I bought them so long ago. That's basically off the top of my head where my investments are.
Well, you obviously bought the dollar, the greenback, at just the right time. You've made that publicly clear on this show every few months for the last year, and it's done nothing but rally and consolidate now for a few months. However, investment du jour for 2016, gold topping the Bloomberg Commodities, actually, index, a top 22, 15%, 3 or 4 months into the year so far. It has a tendency to do this and then disappoint in recent years. Will investors be happy or sad at the end of 2016?
Well, you just said it. It's done it a few times in recent years. I'm not rushing in to buy. I still expect a better opportunity to buy gold sometime in the next 2 or 3 years. If that happens, I hope I'm smart enough to buy more. If it doesn't happen, I own some gold, so I'll make money. But I'm still waiting for my another opportunity.
Talk to us about Russia. The country suffered when oil crashed, the ruble imploded along with West Texas Intermediate crude. Tell us why you like Russia right now. Is it just beaten down, or what opportunity is there?
Well, it is certainly beaten down. I cannot think of any market in the world that's more hated than the Russian stock market, the Russian any market, in fact. And I've learned over the years that if you buy something that's really hated, especially if it's fundamentally sound, you're probably going to do okay. May take some time, but you're probably going to do okay. You know, Russia has huge resources, as you know. It's not a debtor nation. It's still a big creditor nation. Currency is convertible. I mean, they've got problems, but they've been doing the right things. I wish their central banker running our central bank, for instance, she's done a less bad job. Let's leave it at that. And I bought, you know, the rubles down, as you pointed out, the rubles down went down over 50%, oil's down. They're big dependent on oil. So when something's down that much, interest rates are very high, and I bought short-term bonds in rubles. So if the ruble rally, if it just stays where it is, I will be I'll come out ahead.
I remember a week or so ago, we sent a request, and either you or one of your assistants shot back, I'm in Russia right now. Listeners are gaining wisdom here from someone who travels to the places he invests in. I mean, you travel to Moscow. You travel all over the world. I think it probably gives you a perspective, obviously, that the rest of us just don't have. So let's just do a quick summary here and wrap things up. U.S. dollar? Still might have some upside ahead. When that finally peaks out, gold's going to be an opportunity again, and probably the shares as well. U.S. stocks, not as appetizing, perhaps an ultimate peak. Not many places to park assets here.
Well, I'm looking for places. You know, there are places I'm looking at, but I'm really not very active at all. I'm mainly just watching the world unfold. Be knowledgeable, be worried, and be prepared.
Very good.
Thank you, Chris. Bye-bye.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
With central bankers around the globe taking drastic steps these days to keep the global economic system intact, a favorite alternative economist joins us today. He helps guide investors in the right direction. Head of ShadowStats, an alternative economic resource. Welcome back, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
The top story moving the markets last week, clearly the FOMC rate decision on Wednesday. No big surprise there. The Fed funds futures rate were indicating for months in advance that we would hold pat around that quarter to 50 basis points on our overnight lending rate. Can you tell us what this means for investors and where it might lead our FOMC?
Well, I don't take it as good news. In fact, I think it shows that the global banking system, central banking system, the Federal Reserve have no idea how to recover from the crisis of 2008. You had a panic in 2008 where the banking system, domestic banking system, and the global banking system were on the brink of collapse. They took whatever actions were needed to provide the system with liquidity. They created it wherever they had to. They bailed out whatever institution had to be bailed out. They did everything they could to forestall a systemic collapse. What they did not do was address the underlying issues that had led to the trouble, ranging from the economy to the long-term solvency problems for the United States. And so they bought some time, but they've never been able to figure out how to get the system back into stable growth and to basically get the global banking system back to some fundamental stability. It's a very difficult circumstance, one that does not have an easy answer. In many ways, they could pull back from their interventions. They might do better. Let the system try and try to right itself. But they're not about to do that. The Fed is the Fed will do whatever it has to keep the system afloat. The fact that it was so long in raising its rates, and you had perpetual, we're going to raise rates, and I mean, went on for more than a year. They're playing games back and forth, saying, oh, we're going to raise rates, not raise rates. They're playing good cop, bad cop with different Fed directors. You're seeing that now after the Fed raised the rate in December. They hiked the Fed funds rate by a quarter point. And at the time, they were saying there would be a succession of rate increases, most likely starting in March. That quickly disappeared as it became obvious that the economy not only has not recovered, but is beginning to turn down again. Yet after that, the rate decision last week that they did not raise rates, give it 3 or 4 days, sure enough, in come different Fed spokesmen to say, oh, yes, we're going to raise rates next month. So they keep hitting the markets back and forth with this, oh, we're going to raise rates, we're not going to raise rates. But I think what you'll find is that as with the very protracted period it took for the Fed to actually notch rates higher by a quarter point, that it's going to be equally as painful before they take the next move. And in fact, if the economy continues to sink as it appears to be now, and coming into the presidential election year, I'd be very surprised to see any further rate hikes before the election. And in fact, I would expect as the economy continues to deteriorate that the Fed is going to revert back to some form of quantitative easing.
When we talk about quantitative easing, that's really a portfolio now, is it not, of many unconventional methods, techniques, analyses, even sleights of hand, many of which are underboard, not above board. Give us an idea of what you see in their bag of tricks, please.
Well, you have seen other central banks take interest rates negative. I don't see that as having any benefit whatsoever. In fact, the low interest rates here have been very detrimental. The only purpose for the quantitative easing as it was put forth was to prop up the domestic banking system. Again, the Fed's primary function here is to keep the banking system afloat. They had failed in that coming into the panic of 2008. They did everything they could to keep the banking system up. But the economy is secondary here, and there are things they could have done that would have been much stronger for the economy. For example, the quantitative easing. By buying up treasuries from the banks and giving the banks all sorts of cash, they also bought bad assets off the bank's balance sheet, such as mortgage-backed securities and such, which are, all of which are continuing to hold. But had they encouraged banks to lend that money into the normal flow of commerce, you could have had some pickup in economic activity. Instead, the Fed had the banks return the funds to the Fed, effectively depositing them as excess reserves, on which the Fed then paid interest rates, interest to the banks. All this was done to try and stabilize the banking system, increase banking system liquidity. Banks were not able to lend normally. They still are not doing so, but the banks have stayed afloat. That was the Fed's primary mission. They have not done anything really to stimulate the economy. Low rates do not stimulate the economy. That's been a fallacy for a long time. Consider following. You have a lot of people in the United States who at one time lived off interest income. They'd make relatively safe interest income on their savings, the savings account, certificates of deposit, even buying treasury bills. If you go back before the crash, you had a peak in people earning interest income, up around 8% of personal income in 2007. And the year just ended as about 3 percentage points lower, enough to it's knocked $350 billion off of people's annual income. putting that in perspective, total growth in the economy, and this is now before any inflation adjustment, before inflation adjustment, the economy in 2015 gained something like 600 billion. So here you've lost $350 billion, which was more than half of the growth in the economy. That lost personal interest income is put a major crimp into consumer spending. The quantitative easing was the low rates, basically the concept of the quantitative easing. You buy enough enough treasury securities and provide the banks with enough liquidity to drive interest rates close to zero, or now even below zero, which may or may not happen in the United States. But the theory was that this would enable low mortgage rates to encourage people to go out and buy a lot of homes. It helps to restore the housing industry. Despite the low rates, people are still having trouble, even people with good credit are having trouble getting mortgages. 25% of existing home sales are all cash sales. And housing, be it the new home sales, are down actively 60% and 30% from where they were before the recession, before the downturn. I'll contend that the economy never recovered. We crashed into 2009, and then you may have had a little bit of upturn, but generally the economy's been moving along at a low level of stagnation, and it's beginning to turn down again. That has got the Fed very concerned about the banking system because they have a weak economy is not good for banks, but the economy has not been strong. It also means problems for the U.S. Treasury because all the budget projections based on economic growth are not going to pan out. The Treasury is going to have to fund more. And if you look at part of the quantitative easing that the Fed put forth, I mean, they said, yes, we're doing this all to stimulate the economy, but that was the last thing that benefited. The two areas of benefit were, number one, the banking system, and number two is the U.S. Treasury. You've had banks, I mean, you've had central banks such as those in China, Japan, pull back from holding U.S. Treasuries. Who's going to buy Treasuries in this current environment? But the demand for the Treasuries is the volume's increasing. The Fed, in its quantitative easings, when it was actively buying U.S. Treasuries, and it still holds those Treasuries, never sold them. It bought the Treasuries. As it got paid the interest on those Treasuries, it would refund the interest to the Treasury. They effectively monetized, at the time of their active buying, about 7% of the new public debt issuance. That provided liquidity to the government. It needed it, but generally that becomes very heavily inflationary and kills confidence in your currency as it becomes broadly recognized. Nobody much talking about it, but that was the effect. If they go back to quantitative easing, buying more treasuries, they're effectively going to be monetizing debt, providing liquidity to the Treasury, providing liquidity to the banking system, and hoping to avoid a systemic collapse that they were facing back in 2008. Again, all they did back then was to buy time. They did nothing to address the underlying fundamental issues such as the weakening economy or the long-term solvency issues of the U.S. government.
You talk about insolvency of the U.S. government. We've had several guests on the show, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University, who has at least 17 Nobel laureates on his side, having signed his Reform Act that essentially shows in the neighborhood of 200 to 220 our national debt when we include liabilities, unfunded liabilities. Do they have too many options in their arsenal, our authorities, our policymakers, for us to put an accurate time frame on the day of reckoning, as you've referred to it on the show, when the dollar divided by zero comes to pass?
The problem is, while there are options out there for bringing the system into balance, they still are. I'll contend it's a political impossibility. You have to have people who are willing to take actions. The actions tend to address things such as putting Social Security into a position where it's long-term solvent, that Medicare is put into a position where it's long-term solvent. There's nobody in the government at present who's had the political will to address that. And we'll see how the current election turns out. The longer you put off taking action, the more painful become the solutions. And these characters in Washington, rather than face anything as untidy as having to look at making Social Security a solvent system, have put all consideration on this off until after. I mean, they put this off more than a year. A crisis where the rest of the world is looking to say the United States isn't going to address its long-term solvency issues here. If we don't address the long-term solvency issues, there's no way that we could ever pay off unfunded liabilities, net present value, along with our debt that right now, order of magnitude, are $100 trillion. Not a chance. That $100 trillion is what you need in hand to cover that. Not a chance of that happening. So where there have been countries that have been bankrupt in terms of those numbers, the U.S. can always print the money it needs to pay its debt. Well, effectively, what you're, again, doing is monetizing the debt, and that eventually leads to a worthless currency. Are there ways that you could bring the system into balance? Yes, but they're politically painful and there's no political will. And in fact, we continuously move away from it. They play games with it, but we've been continuously moving away from it since the days of they overhauled Medicare, added $8 trillion in unfunded liabilities to the U.S. government portfolio at a time when total federal debt was about $8 trillion, effectively doubled the obligations of the government, and it's just gotten worse since then. Problem is, the rest of the world has little confidence in the U.S. dollar and in the U.S. bringing its financial house in order, bringing the long-term solvency issues under control. So what you need now, the only reason you've had any strength in the dollar has been the continued promise that the U.S. is going to back off its quantitative easing, raise interest rates, which it has done to a certain extent. But if the U.S. Finds that it has to slip back into quantitative easing to prevent a systemic collapse, and they will do that. I mean, they'll do what's needed to prevent collapse. That will hit the dollar hard, and you'll start seeing a very sharp rise in inflation here as oil prices spike again. Oil prices are very closely tied to the dollar. I know there's an oil glut out there, but oil is denominated in dollars. If the Fed goes back towards quantitative easing, you're going to see significant weakness in the dollar, dropping 10-20%. We've had extraordinary dollar strength in the last couple of years, which I did not expect. But you can lose that just as easily, and this, again, is all tied to how the quantitative easing is handled at the moment. They move back, you see a heavy dollar sell-off, big spike in oil prices, big spike in domestic inflation. This is not hyperinflation, but we're talking moving off the ridiculously low inflation numbers that we're seeing at the moment. That, however, does start the inflationary cycle anew with the rest of the world in similar circumstance. I don't see a happy solution here. The people say this is going to end in a deflation. As a reason for this, a collapse of debt, a lot of debt will be defaulted on. I would not be at all shocked to see a lot of a debt default, but that's not necessarily deflationary up front. Where you have the fear of the great deflation, such as seen was seen back in the 30s, that was due to a collapse in the money supply that came from the failure of banks. Where in those days, if you had your money on deposit with the bank, you had no backup from the government. Bank went under, you lost your cash, and the money supply contracted. Money supply dropped by about a third, and so did the economy. Today, you saw what happened in 2008. Didn't make any difference what the FDI insurance was. All deposits were guaranteed. The central banks, the Fed, will not let the banking system collapse. They'll do everything they can to prevent a great deflation. But, of course, those two things are closely tied to each other. So as we run into continuing crisis here again, we're still seeing unfold the crisis of 2008. the threats to the banking system, they're going to do whatever they have to do to keep it afloat. They made a decision then to put us into a long-term bailout of the system with the ultimate price being hyperinflation as opposed to accepting a crash in the system and a deflationary crash. They opted for inflation back in 2008. That's where we're going to be.
2008, we all know the modus operandi that our officials, policymakers around followed the same, do whatever it takes to keep the House of Cards from completely imploding. This time around, back at near record highs in the U.S. stock indices, some folks take as an indicator that it's economic business as usual. But if you look underneath the surface, the numbers are just abysmal.
They are abysmal. Look, the stock market's been used as a ploy by Wall Street for decades. I mean, the stock market's a very happy American institution. Many people have made good money off it. I'm very happy for them. But what we're seeing right now is a fantasy world, and it's being propped by, among others, the central bank. I mean, the Fed's funding here has flowed through to certain areas, particularly to from banks to corporations to borrow money so they can buy back their shares. That's a good way to prop the stock market. Yeah, what you do there, you buy up your shares, so you reduce the number of shares outstanding, and guess what? Your revenues per share, your earnings per share all spike, not because you're seeing great earnings and revenues. I mean, their revenues are down year to year. Your revenues are down in a manner that would normally, and indeed are confirming, that we're in a recession, irrespective of what you're getting out of the GDP reporting. But that reflects headline numbers that they use to keep jimmying up the stock prices, basically reflective of sharply reduced shares outstanding. It's not that you're seeing surging earnings and revenues, and even the headline ones are suffering. That they do everything they can to drive people into the stock market. Where are you going to put? Some people went to gold, and I certainly still advocate that as a long-term hedge against what's happening. It's not a day-to-day trading thing, but you get it, hang on to it, it's going to save you in the end. Yet you get central bank intervention to knock down gold prices to discourage people from owning this. You've seen very deliberate ploys here to try and drive people into stocks. They hope that the stock market rally will create wealth, and that wealth effect will stimulate the economy. Well, they've had their stock market rally and whatever wealth creation they're going to get with it, and it still hasn't stimulated the economy. The stock market's the last place I'd want to be. But I'm not very popular with Wall Street.
You know, you brought up, I think, an important point en passant. Why not just put your money in a safe? Well, the best way to put your money in a safe is through precious metals. This is a growing trend because their central bankers have given them very little opportunity. For the longest time, we heard the mantra on Wall Street, precious metals offer little to no interest. I mean, it's very difficult to earn interest off of the metals. There are a few ETFs and in sundry ways that one can go about it. But now people are concerned that not only will they not draw interest, but they also will lose principal simply by handing their funds over, their investment, their retirement money to the banking system. Personal safes, home safes, a big growing trend. Do you see that trend extending to the United States in the next few years?
Oh, I suspect you'll see that's already happened. Of course, if you have a safe, you have a safe cracker business, they'll look for safes too. I mean, I've had questions in this area a long time. Where do you put your precious metals? And local coin dealer, I've used one of the national television shows and asked that. And he says, well, you know, I've got a client who buys large silver bars. He paints them black and uses them as doorstops. I'm not advocating anything like that per se, but usually the nice thing about precious metals is that they don't take up much space, and whether you put them in a safe, your sock drawer, where people would be even less likely to look, just make sure that your family or those who would otherwise be interested in it know where it is. To hold gold physically, not by paper, it's the physical gold that will be of great value here, and generally favor sovereign coins over anything else, because as you get into a crazy circumstance, you may well see a lot of counterfeiting of things such as bars. And right now, if you have a sovereign coin, you take it to a coin dealer, usually the coin dealer just take it at face, and not an issue. But if you go in with a borrower, you may have someone who wants to assay it. And you get into difficult times, it's much better to have something that's easily accepted as opposed to something that someone's going to want to survey or assay or
look at the value that one has with individual coins. There's not too much, I think, of a markup to go that route, let's say, over, as you mentioned, bars, which have come quite a long way, though. With, if you get into the large increments, you're going to want to probably have established a track record with a very well-known distributor, wholesaler, and likely maintain that relationship there. So I think it's a point well made. There's still a lot of topicality we haven't covered, you know, the domestic economy. We're supposedly firing on all eight cylinders. They're considering putting the brakes on. They did once already, and it looks like we might see maybe another quarter point up to 75 basis points this year. A pretty solid chance by maybe fall, at least if the Fed funds futures hold. Do you think that would be the last, and just what might that mean for investors?
I don't think you're going to see any further rate hikes. I mean, they're not recently they've not been touting the rate hikes because of the strong economy. It's because, inflation's coming back. Well, the inflation that they're touting, you know, 2% target rate is the so-called core inflation rate, which excludes food and energy. Yet they backed off of this last rate, and they did not even highlight the core rate. It's nonsense. Their primary concern here is saving the banking system. And if the economy is not recovering, the banking system is going to continue in trouble, and they're going to do whatever they have to do to keep the banking system afloat, which means, if it means quantitative easing, they're going to do it irrespective of the inflation risk. That's what they did back 2008. They've already made the decision to accept the inflation. You think the economy is booming. With the headline inflation numbers, 95% of the movement there has been in oil prices. It hasn't been tied at all to economic activity. It's all been in oil prices, and that's tied to the dollar. It's not that they can slow down the economy and bring inflation under control. The inflation issue here at the moment is beyond economic activity. It's not the economy that's contributing, maybe subtracting from it, but it certainly is not contributing. And the driving force is has been the weakness in oil prices. Again, as the dollar tumbles, you'll find oil prices spiking, and you'll find inflation spiking. But that's not going to be a circumstance where they're going to want to raise rates, because the economy is going to get worse and worse. You can have very negative effects from inflation on the economy, real cost. We saw some of that back when oil prices were rising. The people have limited income. The price of gasoline goes up. They've got to go to work. They're going to buy the gasoline to go to work, but they're not going to buy as much otherwise if their income's limited. So that becomes a negative for the economy, not plus. As the inflation we're looking at does not have anything to do with economic activity. In fact, we are in a recession, and it's getting worse. You can see that again if you look at the revenues of the S&P 500. Look at it on a not per share basis. Back out the share buyback effects. You'll see it if you look at the pattern of freight activity in the United States since 2000. There are all sorts of indicators such as that in the stock market that show you in terms of basic underlying activity that, yep, the economy collapsed into 2009 and maybe came back a little bit, but basically it's been flat since, and now it's turning down. You're seeing that again in a number of broad measures, including that the government's housing statistics, total oil consumption. I just saw some numbers the other day. Someone showed me that aggregate physical oil consumption, petroleum-related consumption in the United States, shows the same pattern. The only thing that the GDP, and that's a very heavily inflated number, you know, the GDP right now is 10% above of a pre-recession high. If the economy were that strong, the Fed would not be debating whether or not we were in a recovery. How could the Federal Reserve be debating we're in a recovery and be concerned about that if the statistics are as strong as you're getting out of Washington? The reality is along the lines of, yes, we're still in a recession, and it's getting worse.
We've never really had a solid recovery when the numbers are inflation adjusted properly since the year 2000, a stock market peak. I mean, we're looking at a multi-generational recession that makes the 1970s, I think, pale.
Yes. Oh, this is, we haven't had anything like this since the 30s. And it's probably going to get worse than that. I mean, I don't see any way out of this at the moment. The best thing they can do is just back off and let the system become self-righting. But part of the problem is they're over-managing. They're doing that very specifically at the moment because they can't let the banking system fail.
But could it be that economic conditions have changed in a way that perhaps even we and Cognoscenti have not fully grasped? I mean, look at the way in which robotics and automation, a major retailer, Carl's Jr., I think it is, one of these major restaurants, that is very seriously considering 100% robot-facilitated restaurants, hundreds, thousands of them around the world. When that type of trend catches on, you start to see displacement of workers in a very rapid pace, like an anti-industrial revolution.
You certainly are seeing some things moving in that direction in terms of, and then probably gets down as to how you want to view and measure economic activity. I look at it from the aggregate standpoint and how the population in general is doing. The theory behind the national income account, and as bad as the quality, reporting quality is there, and the gimmicks they have with the inflation, that they have two sides of the gross domestic product. One is the consumption side, investment side. The other is the income side. You need to have a balance. If your population is not working and is impoverished, you don't have a healthy circumstance. I don't care how well it's going. Now, yes, over time, things should balance out. Let the system work itself through. Certainly part of the change you're seeing here is technological. That's always been the case. Automobiles replacing horses. So that's, you go through massive changes and the system readjusts and people readjust. And we haven't gotten to a position yet that the economy has decided you don't need people. And unfortunately, you got to figure out a way to pay the people if they're going to consume the stuff that otherwise drive the economy. So it's, there are things that will get worked out. And you may have disruptions from this, but the fundamental issues here with the economy, at least is being suffered in the United States, not making ends meet, and the primary cause behind that is the loss of jobs, higher-paying jobs to offshore competition. You can tie that directly to deliberately bad trade policies by the U.S. government. The effect of the trade policies has been to redistribute U.S. productive wealth to the rest of the world. Corporations have enjoyed that. That's fine. I mean, that's part of, you know, part of your business and business planning, your business strategies. But the what's been missed here is that all this free trade that is throwing U.S. productivity and productive wealth to the rest of the world. I mean, the reason we were such a great consumer of all sorts of products and all sorts of great products tied to leisure activity, and it was because the country was made a living where he had some disposable income after the fact, had some wealth. That has largely been redistributed to the rest of the world, and we've come to a point. I think we've reached that point where the rest of the world's beginning to scratch its head. What's happening? We're going into recession here. They're making products that they can't consume, but they've transfer of production to these offshore operations have killed the income in the United States that otherwise would be used to buy the products. So that you're seeing a self-defeating system. That's it all gets worked out in the end, but you have to let the system work its way through.
Allowing the forest to clear the underbrush, the boat or the ship to right itself. George Soros made, I think, an apt analogy, and he says, look, 2008 can be likened to a oil tanker. For the longest time, would just capsize until they realized we need to compartmentalize so that momentum would not pick up in any one direction. And when a big wave came, you didn't have a disappearing multi-billion-dollar container. We've got to compartmentalize, and I'd like to know just how you think authorities and policymakers might do this.
I wish they'd just sit on their hands and let the economy take its own course. I'm tired of the micromanagement that has really destroyed the system. It's been destroyed more for the benefit of special financial interests than anything else. I don't trust the current officials to do anything that would be fundamentally helpful here other than for self-interest. I know that's a terrible thing to say, but frankly, that's where I think we stand. I think that's why you're getting the political furor that you have right now, and maybe there'll be some changes. I don't know.
And I think that is the natural backlash, blowback.
What they need to do is just back off, let the system see what the system does.
Laissez-faire economics. Interesting.
Yeah, effectively, yes. But I think that is now is the time for that.
Gold, of course, topping the list of the metals on the Bloomberg Index, still up around 15% to 16% in just a few months' time.
These are probably the most unstable times anyone living today is going to see, at least in terms of where it heads and certainly where we've been. I look at gold as the ultimate hedge. Preserving asset here, including silver, the precious metals. We've got terrible times ahead with the economy, with inflation. To the extent that you hold gold long-term, I'm not into day-to-day trading of anything here. I'm just looking at gold as a store of wealth. And as a store of wealth that can preserve your assets, preserve your wealth in terms of purchasing power, through it's going to be probably an eventual full debasement of the U.S. dollar here. My timing on that's been miserable. I've certainly looked at it well ahead of it happening. But the underlying fundamentals continue to move in that direction. That's where we're heading. That's what the central banks have confirmed with their quantitative easing policies. They could have gone towards deflation, but they're pushing it towards inflation. They don't have a way out. So you want to look at the long term here, preserving your assets against a terrible inflation ahead. And gold is that asset, and it gets up to $10,000. Don't sell it if the crisis hasn't passed, because you'll see it up at $100,000, and you're going to see it at $1 million, depending upon how far they let the dollar go before we end up with a different currency.
What's so astounding to me are some of the more conservative guests calling for $10,000 now at the lower end. Folks who, frankly, would never have dreamed. You wouldn't have heard words like, I like that you pointed out silver. Now, sure, we're around, let's say, 80-1 on the gold-to-silver ratio. Traditionally, that's a bargain. However, I would simply note out on a long-term, and I mean a long-term basis, considering that, you know, we're looking at a 10-to-1 ratio in the ground, constant. Silver makes a lot of sense for those of us who are, you know, bourgeois, middle class, everyday, hardworking folks. This is a bargain.
I'm looking at a circumstance here where you may be using precious metals to stay alive, to buy your, effectively trade for ongoing necessities. Gold is going to be the bigger store of wealth item because it's because of its relative value on just in terms of weight and volume. Silver coins, and again, I would stay in this type of hedging position going forward. I would tend to use the sovereign coins. The silver coins would make smaller change. So to speak, it'd be easier to transact business with that. The dollar becomes worthless. So from the basic standpoint of long-term hedging.
John Williams, please tell our listeners today a bit more about this must-bookmark website, shadowstats.com.
Well, we have a fair amount of information on it. I've got hyperinflation reports up in the right-hand column, and you can read those. The basics there still hold. Obviously, we're not in a hyperinflation at this point, but the underlying fundamentals outline where it is going to go. I have no question of that. It's just the timing. Publish alternative estimates on inflation, economic growth, We show the money supply M3, which the government stopped publishing. Also offer effectively weekly commentary, put out a commentary at least once a week, that addresses the headline economic statistics and the developments in the broad economy and circumstance. Reasonably priced, I feel. It's not one of these $10,000 services. Can't subscribe to them. Have it up there for $175 a year, $89 for 6 months. Always happy to pick up new subscribers. But in any event, I think you'll find that the information on our site is a value in and of itself. If you read the hyperinflation comments, you're interested in the comments today, you'll get some much greater detail than we've discussed.
John Williams, what a pleasure, sir.
Again, thanks for having me, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Arriva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with PunkerChange.com. MarketWatch headed up a healthcare article this week about a report from the Association of American Medical Colleges about how America's rapidly growing doctor shortage is right around the corner, and how the United States could lose over 90,000 doctors by 2025. Many of whom will be primary care physicians. There are many situations that have been adversely impacting healthcare since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Growing pressures on reimbursements for providers at all levels. Restructuring and, in practice, rationing of many critical primary care services. Skyrocketing insurance and deductible costs as new plan structures are announced each year. The disappearance of primary care doctors is not a new phenomenon. Its demographics and metrics have been known for some time. But now the growth curve on those metrics are reaching breakout velocity and will soon be felt by everyone. According to the American Medical College's report, primary care physicians will account for as much as one-third of the coming 90,000-plus doctor shortage. Nationwide, about 65 million people live in what's referred to as a primary care desert. This primary care gap is acute in one-third of the states, which, according to government statistics, have only half or less of their primary care needs being met. Of course, everyone wants to pass the buck on the true origins of this problem and pretend it's a class warfare issue by pointing out how specialists make twice as much or sometimes three times as much as primary care physicians. So it must be the greed of those individuals that is a large part of the problem. Or if that doesn't fly, blame the medical schools for turning out too many specialists. But the blame game only goes so far, because the physician shortage will persist under every potential solution being considered, including increased use of advanced practice nurses, greater use of alternate settings such as retail clinics, delayed physician retirement, and other modeled scenarios. The real culprit in all of this, the real cause, dates back to 1965, when Lyndon Johnson pushed Medicare and Medicaid through Congress. The original proponents of national health care in the 1960s argued they were not seeking control of how doctors provided care for their patients. They simply wanted to pay the bills. My, how times have changed. In 1985, author Leonard Peikoff delivered a lecture at the Ford Hall Forum called Medicine, the Death of a Profession, which you can find online. It was written 20 years after the implementation of Medicare and Medicaid, and it's now been 30 years since the creation of that lecture. For anyone who has followed the medical profession closely, or had family involved in it like I have, you will see the decline and prognostication discussed by Peikoff a generation ago. At the time, the introduction of the DRG, or the Diagnosis-Related Group, where the government had divided all ailments at that time into 468 possible diagnoses and set in advance a fixed, arbitrary fee for each, was implemented. In 2007, author Rick Mays said this about DRGs. For the first time, the federal government gained the upper hand in its financial relationship with the hospital industry. Medicare's new prospective payment system with DRGs triggered a shift in the balance of political and economic power between the providers of medical care, hospitals and physicians, and those who paid for it, power that providers had successfully accumulated for more than half a century. Government involvement into free markets often turns into confrontation. When entrepreneurs and independent business people are turned into employees, as has happened with the medical profession over the past 50 years, people eventually leave. In the end, costs go up, bureaucracies grow, patients get less attention and potentially less care. And those charged with looking at the problem from today's perspective seldom look at the machinations of change over 50 years. If they did, they would understand declines in certain physician populations are no mystery. And we are beginning to reap the fruits of what was first sown back in 1965, when no one was listening. Because when it comes to healthcare, when we look carefully at the warning signs in our past, we discover our future. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.